Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, adjacent to Roberta's Pizzeria and Restaurant. It's so funny to call it Roberta's Pizzeria somehow. It's so much more than that. Roberta's ground zero for the Brooklyn artisanal food movement. We broadcast a show about my favorite subject, everyone's favorite subject these days, taste. And today we're going to be continuing in some ways our conversation we've been having over the last few weeks about authenticity and nostalgia and this idea that the food that we eat is really the sum of past experiences and past food cultures and also visions of future things and future tastes and some idea of cuisine. And we're going to be talking about that in a new context. We think sometimes of American food, America, and certainly New York, as the ultimate melting pot, especially when it comes to food, where you can get sort of foods from all sorts of cultures, authentic or otherwise, as we've been exploring in the last few weeks. But there are certainly other countries, other cultures that whose foods are made up of many different traditions. I think of Singapore, which obviously has the four main cuisines, and also, not to be forgotten, Israel, which is a country of immigrants just like America, although perhaps nothing like America in some ways. There are some similarities. And today we are really fortunate to have with us in the studio someone who probably has thought about and considered the tastes of Israel and the food, Jewish foods in general, but also their representations in New York as I don't know what to call you quite, Nama, maybe a culinary cultural ambassador or impresario. Nama Sheffi, welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much, Mitchell. It's great to be here. Fun.
It is fun. We're just going to continue the conversation we were having before and that we'll have after, and people can listen into this period. But someone I love to talk about food with because Nama brings not just food culture, but art and an incredibly creative and I would say avant-garde, except that I mean that in the most delicious way, the delicious sense, all of the cultural aspects of things that make life fun in New York and in the world together in the things that you do. So tell us a little bit about the, you know, from your perspective, what's going on right now in New York, but also in Israel with food. There seems to be this incredible fascination, restaurants opening, bakeries opening here in New York, but also I keep hearing about the incredible things people are eating in Tel Aviv.
Right. It's exploding.
Yeah, it's exploding.
Here in New York, but also in Tel Aviv. But I want to just to touch back to start with the melting pot idea. And for me, you know, people always talk about Israel as a melting pot society. But when I compare it to other immigrant societies, I'd rather use the term pressure cooker.
Okay, pressure cooker. I'll give you that.
Yeah, because of the intense pressure under which Israeli live in Israel. And it's accelerated the fusion of these, you know, more than 70 different ethnicities, or if you want, ingredients.
Right. And you mean pressure both because of the sort of political situation there and also...
Yes, political, right. Economic. Okay. It's such a, you know, tiny, small piece of land.
Right, and in the middle of people who don't like it very much, right, let's say. I mean, we can say that, right?
Yes, for sure. And, you know, if you compare it to other immigrant societies like America... It's kind of intense.
Right.
Think how many years it took a bowl of pasta to land on an Irish dining table.
Right.
Family, you know, it may be 7 years or more. I don't know,
Here.
Like dozens of decades.
Well, it's a good question. Yeah, people were living, Irish and Italians were living pretty closely in the Lower East Side. So
exactly.
One wonders, right.
But in Israel, it took like, it was very, very fast.
Okay.
I mean, I think I'm a live example of this cooking pressure melting pot,
uh-huh.
Right? Like doing this scuba thing or other things.
We'll get to that, yeah.
We'll get to that. But, you know, my heritage is Polish. And I consider hummus or kube or schnitzel to be my own, to be Israeli.
Okay.
So.
Right. Not pierogi and borscht. No, not so much.
Maybe borscht.
Okay, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
So in amidst this melting pot and this sort of quick fusion, I mean, is there really a fusion, or do things stay separate but people appreciate them? I guess that's one question. Like, does the pressure force them together on the same table in the same meal, or are the communities and the foods and the cuisines staying somewhat distinct?
Yes. Sometimes you can find it. You know, you can go to Friday night dinner, which is an institution all over across the board in Israel,
sure.
And you can find, you know, a Polish chicken soup and then a couscous, Moroccan couscous, next to an Austrian schnitzel and pickles from...
You're making me hungry, and it's only 11, right? I just ate breakfast.
I know, and a cheesecake for dessert. So it's kind of, yeah, you can see these fusions on the plate, on one plate.
Okay, and so here in New York, I mean, which is a funny place, I think, because probably the most Jewish city outside of Tel Aviv, I would think, is New York City. There might even be more Jews here, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the traditional Jewish cuisine of New York, you know, the Ashkenazi food, which has been distilled down into deli, delicatessen, an appetizing shop, and maybe Sammy's Romanian, none of which, I mean, it's all familiar, but
right.
It's not all necessarily good, was disappearing, I think, in my lifetime. It became harder and harder to find that anywhere, and certainly anything good. And then one day, you know, on St. Mark's Place, something called the Hummus Place opened. I remember it distinctly, and suddenly...
Right.
There were more, and then there were falafel places, and then there were Israeli food shops, and then there were fancy Israeli restaurants,
right.
And now there's a bakery, and something happened. What do you think happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's about time.
It's about time, okay. Speaking of pressure cooker,
exactly, and I think that Israel is one of the most, in Israel, you can find one of the most exciting food culture right now in the world. I mean... It's truly about time. And I was lucky enough to listen to your show the other day and listen to Francis Lam talked about authenticity. Mm-hmm. And he said that it's a moving target.
Right?
And I can't agree more.
Right.
And that's why it's so interesting to see the adaptation that Israeli chefs and restaurateurs are doing now in New York. And last week I read this very interesting article that Ronit Vered, this amazing food writer in Israel, she did an interview with Yotam Ottolenghi,
mm-hmm.
And he said...
Who's been on the show, Yotam, from London, and the new book, Jerusalem, just to clarify, right?
Which is another phenomenon,
right,
which
of course,
I think it's interesting.
Related in some ways.
And Yotam said that in London, one of the most best-seller dishes that he has on the menu, it's sweet potatoes and figs, which is like... People think of it as very Israeli dish.
Okay.
But he said that in Israel, he would never even find such a dish.
Right.
So these adaptations are super creative and interesting, I feel.
Right, of course. And there's a funny... I feel over the last fall, we were on a lot of panels together. Either you had coordinated them and curated the speakers, or you were in the audience. And there's been an explosion, just an interest in Jewish food in general. And by that, some people mean, you know, the Ashkenazi traditions, familiar with New York. But partly when you're involved, you're always trying to include the Israeli tradition, which is becoming increasingly important, as we're talking about, and perhaps even has more to contribute from a gastronomic standpoint. And yet, I think New Yorkers are a little trepidatious about it because it doesn't resonate as familiar. I mean, it's healthy and beautiful and delicious, the food that's
right.
going on there. I had a funny conversation with the guys at Bread's, the new bakery from Tel Aviv that opened at Union Square, where I said it felt very Japanese in the bakery to me, just
mm-hmm.
the way you helped yourself and the display of the breads
right.
and reminded me of Tokyo. And they looked at me like I was from Mars because they thought it just feels like a Jewish bakery. And I just started laughing because nothing about a clean, modern environment in the New York experience feels like a Jewish bakery. That's Moishe's on Second Avenue with
an
old
Moishe's.
Man. And the flour has that's worked its way into the shelves. And
exactly.
The dry, choked down kichel and hamantaschen. And so there's this funny reconciliation that has to happen, I think, for us to consider it even Jewish food. Israeli food Israeli cuisine is something different for us.
Absolutely. And I think part of the reason is also how Israelis are treating their own identity as Jewish or Israeli. Because when Jewish people immigrated to the United States, they tried to stick with their identity through food. And in Israel, you know, it's the Jewish state, so you don't need to prove your Jewishness all the time.
Right. Then interesting.
Like, everybody's Jewish, so you want, I mean, I think about myself as an Israeli, and then I'm also Jewish.
Right.
Culturally.
Because you come from Israel, and
yeah.
Ergo, right?
And, yes, and also food-wise, let's go back to the years before the State of Israel was born, when the few settlers arrived at the end of the 19th century, arrived to Israel, and flew from their atrocities in Europe. So, you know, they searched for a new identity. They wanted to be, you know, the new Israeli. So they kind of rejected the diaspora. And for inspiration, they looked for, you know, to the Palestinians who were there. And from them, they learned how to work the land, what to wear, what to cook, what to eat. So this relationship started back then.
How's that going?
going great.
It's a different show, right? We talked about that a little bit with Yotam, obviously, and Sammy, which I think represents so many interesting things about food and culture in that region. And I think that's part of the success of that book is that exploration together of the Palestinian and Israeli relationship. But for another show, one of the things that I love about talking to you is you have all of these wonderfully creative ideas of ways, as I said earlier, to pull artists into food events and to pull food into artistic events and that kind of thing. And you're working on something right now that you mentioned called the Kube Project. And I would love for you to explain what Kube is, for starters, and also why the Kube Project came to be and what it is.
Sure. So every Middle Eastern community has its own version of meat dumpling.
Of meat dumpling, the meatball or something.
Yes.
Like we might call it.
Yeah.
A naked knish, nudie knish.
Exactly. and in Iraq and Kurdistan, it's Kube. So basically Kube is a meatball, very flavorful with baharat, which we talk about it in a second. It's a mix of spices. Very flavorful meatball that encased into a shell of semolina and simmered in this tangy, amazing soup. So the shell absorbs the flavors of the soup, and that's why it's tricky. I mean, you really need to get the dumpling right and then to have a great stew.
Okay.
So in some ways, it's the stepbrother of the matzo ball. I would say. But the tricky thing is it's super time intensive and labor intensive.
Okay.
To make the kube, and you even for experienced cook, it's a lot of work. And I think that's one of the reason why Jewish people in Iraq used to make it for Shabbat or for other special occasions.
Okay.
And in her book, The Food of Jewish Food, Claudia Rodin talked about it, that if we don't do something, you know, right now,
to preserve this
food will, you know, if I may.
Sure, of course.
I want to read this, you know, a quote from this book. And Claudia says, "When the last generation who makes kube has disappeared, I accept these dishes will not be carried on because they take too long. I hope Jerusalem keeps up her reputation as the capital, and that some food producer will decide to make them commercially so that the whole little world of our culinary culture does not disappear."
So you've taken it upon yourself to preserve the cuvée. You've taken Claudia Rodin's charge to heart.
I mean, it's a very small and modest attempt, you know? I called Claudia and and she's a huge inspiration for me. And I told her about the project and she was very excited and hopefully she make it to New York. But
so what's involved? What are you doing?
So the Cuvée Project is a pop-up restaurant that will take place at Zucker Bakery, another place that I adore in the city.
An Israeli bakery.
Okay. And for 3 weeks, starting March 1st, we'll serve three types of cuvée. Beet cuvée, which is, you know, like a sweet and sour kind of soup, uh-huh. Purple, beautiful. And then pumpkin cuvée, velvety variation of cuvée, and chamusta, which is a very sour, tangy soup made out of zucchinis, lemons, and Swiss chard. So that would be the three varieties. The three types.
And those are all very traditional?
They are traditional. We're doing some adaptations, mm-hmm. But they are traditional. We're going also to serve sabich.
Which is? I mean, I know what it is, yeah. But I don't think people listening know what it is.
So, again, sabich originated in Jewish Iraqi Shabbat breakfast. So it was a cold spread made out of hard-boiled egg, eggplants, parsley, hummus, and amba, which is a spicy condiment made from unripe mangoes. And that was, you know, that was the breakfast for these people. And over the years in Israel, this cold spread turned into a combo, into a sandwich. Mm. And now it's like one of the most popular street foods in Israel. So this is another interesting idea because, you know, Israeli food draws its inspiration from ethnic Jewish food.
Right. We're going to think about all of those flavors you just mentioned in the sabich.
Sabich.
Yeah, it's not sabich. It's not ceviche. It's not fish.
You're doing good.
Sabich. While we take a short break, you're listening to Taste Matters.
You're listening to IDID by Obesity on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Naama Shefi about Israeli traditions and new fusions and a project of hers called the Cuvée Project, where she's trying single-handedly to preserve the Iraqi Jewish tradition of meat dumplings simmered in tangy soup, let's say. I
want to mention my partner for this project.
Sure.
Itamar Levinson is a chef that came specifically for this project to do it with me here in New York.
So he's from Israel?
He's from Israel. He got his culinary education here in New York at ICE.
Uh-huh.
And worked, and I think he did his stage at Dovotel at the Upper West Side. And then spend a few years working with Rafi Cohen in Tel Aviv, uh-huh. Raphael. Mm-hmm. So I thought it would be, you know, the perfect match.
Let me, before we get into a little bit more about that, let me just tell listeners that you can call us if you have questions about perhaps how to make kubeh, or maybe how to start a pop-up, or even what's going on in Israel right now in the food scene, by calling us at 718-497-2128. Or you can email us if you would prefer to type, or if you're listening to the podcast at info@heritageradionetwork.com. You can also tweet us at Taste Matters, HRN.
This is so great.
This is so great, where people are sitting down to lunch outside the studio where we are. And so we're chatting. It's almost like we're eating here, although we're not yet.
Soon enough.
I'm not even sure how to say this question. Mm-hmm. What would, as an Israeli who loves New York and loves to live here, what would sort of successful acceptance of all of the stuff going on be for you? In a city that has so many different food traditions and different ethnicities meeting together, where would you think Israeli food would be? I mean, a falafel shop on every corner, or is it something more than that?
Yeah, I mean, falafel shop in every corner is not interesting. And I don't think it's also like interesting translation into the super vibrant,
right,
creative thing that is going on now in Israel. Just more attempt, just more interpretations like Balabusta and Taboon and Zucker Bakery are doing, just more of it, mm-hmm. I feel. I mean, yeah, it's easier maybe to speak about the trends in Israel.
Sure, I was going to ask what's going on there. Who are the people there? Yeah.
So again, it's exploding right now. Mm-hmm. And one of the trends that I think that I witnessed in the last years is the street food. Mm-hmm. Street food that is dressed up, is more creative. So it's not just the shawarma in a pita.
Right.
It's all sort of things in a pita. It's shrimp in a pita. It's steak in a pita. It's a sinia in a pita. It's cauliflower in a pita.
So what was the last one?
Sinia, which is a Palestinian dish. It's like meatball that cooked in a tahini sauce, mm-hmm. Which is also interesting technique that now Israeli chefs are doing, cooking things in tahini.
Are there any known Palestinian chefs cooking Palestinian food?
That's a good question. There is the chef of Haj Kahil, Omar Suleiman, but I can't, you know, say that he is a celebrity,
right,
like the other Israeli chef. I would love to see that.
Well, because one of the conversations we've been having with Francis Lam, you referred to, and also Krishna Dure, was that there's this unwritten or even unobserved, unchallenged phenomenon where an American chef, in this context, in the famous people, Rick Bayless and Mexican cuisine, or even Danny Bowen, who is Asian but isn't Chinese, and his Chinese cuisine, that these appropriations, Stupak, who then become, right, Alex Stupak, who then become famous as authorities, and even though they deny vehemently that they're not of these cultures and they are just students,
right,
they somehow become famous, and the Mexican chef who makes the great tacos doesn't. And I mean, these are cultural phenomenons beyond food and the restaurants, but I'm just curious about your observations about that.
Right. I mean, let's see about Israeli food in the United States. I think the most famous chef is Michael Solomonov.
In Philadelphia,
sure. In Zahav, which is not Israeli. I mean,
right,
he has Israeli, I think, parent, I think, his father, but is American, who is cooking an amazing Israeli food.
Right.
Einat Admoni is also a great example, but she's a total Israeli.
And she's from?
Her
restaurants, to say everybody.
I'm sorry, yeah. Balabusta, and the owner of Taim.
Right.
And she's about to open another restaurant.
Oh, exciting. You heard it here first.
Yeah, super exciting. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. And it, so describe a little bit more the outside the street food, the sort of higher level of restaurant, what's happening there. How would you know someone's cooking Israeli quote unquote food or influenced by Israel? What is Michael Solomonov doing that marks it as Israeli?
So again, I want to go back now to Israel, okay, because I think that what's interesting, it's not that some that these chefs are doing something so particular with ingredients or cooking style. I think more than anything else is the Israeli spirit, is the atmosphere, is the experience. The sense of community is so strong in Israel. And when you go out, even for, you know, a fancy restaurant, you will feel it. Yeah, like you'll share the experience with other diners. Here in New York, when you go to, you know, all the fancy restaurant, the tasting counters and all that, it's very preserved, like for you, very
discreet. I love the idea of the communal table in New York where everyone sits together alone. Everyone's you try to avoid interacting in any way with your neighbors.
In the Cuba Project will force you to interact.
But will that work? That's a lovely phenomenon, but I feel like...
It's an experiment. Yeah, let's see.
Right.
I mean, I love at my land. I feel that there is more. I mean, the design, it's not straight, but...
Zigzag.
Yeah. I think it contribute to this sense. But in Israel, if you go to Machne Yehuda, this restaurant in the market in Jerusalem, it's all about the experiment. It's like so loud, so unpretentious. It's in your face if you love it or not. But that's the deal. So in many ways, I would love to see New York more from this. Maybe grilled meats on the skewer, like ala esh, like, you know, barbecue Shippudim tradition.
Shippudim,
which is great. And I know that Rafi Cohen, the chef from Rafael in Israel, is about to open an ala esh restaurant in Tel Aviv, which I'm super excited about.
Wow. So there's the things you've described all sound really healthy in our current understanding of healthy food, and I don't think we think of Israeli food necessarily as Mediterranean cuisine, but what you've described.
Israel is a cooking nation, and it's Jana Gurza, the editor of Al HaShulchan, On the Table. She says many times that it's a salad nation.
Salad for breakfast, certainly.
People eat salad three times a day.
Right.
So it's obvious, like people really love vegetables in Israel. Little kids are eating vegetables in Israel. And it's interesting because I spoke on this panel at the New School University about Jewish food, the local and the global. And I called to some of the most important chefs in Israel to give me their definition of what is the most Israeli dish. And of course that all of them gave me completely different answers, but Erez Komorowski, which I admire, said that for him the most Israeli dish is Arabic salad.
Which is...
And he added a smiley to his email. Like, it's Arabic, but it's Israeli.
Right. We call it Israeli salad, but it's... But that's the cucumbers and tomatoes and...
Just finely chopped cucumber, tomatoes, onions, other herbs vegetables, like parsley or cilantro, whatever you like, but it's... Right. So, that's the essence, basically.
And, wow, interesting. And...
Because I don't think it's going to be big in New York.
But I love it. I don't know. Why not? But for breakfast, people are so squeamish when it comes to breakfast. And what's funny is, of course, when anyone thinks about Jewish food or you look at the jokes from the Jewish comedians in the Catskills, there's never been a vegetable that's ever been cooked on an Ashkenazi New York Jewish table unless it was a pickle.
But this is a misunderstanding of Jewish food. I think this is so particular, you know, Eastern European that immigrated here. It's great, but Jews used to live, you know, all over the world.
Right.
I mean, the story tells that in the year of 70, Jews exiled from the land of Israel, right?
Right.
And the Palestinians were there.
We'll be celebrating that soon, coming up. There's a holiday, anyway.
Yes. So... So yeah, Jews used to live in Iran and in Morocco and in Poland and Hungary, all over the place, and created their own little variation and tiny cuisines.
Right. In fact, I love the quote from Barbara Kirshenblatt-Gimlet, who's a Jewish folklorist and culinary historian and all sorts of other things, but who said the only recipe in the Bible is matzah. Everything else is interpretation.
Right.
Right. So everything else is close to where people were living. And so, but the ones who are living here all happen to share an experience that has been maligned. I mean, even when I was traveling in Israel, we've talked about this before, I felt so proudly Ashkenazic because my food is nowhere to be found practically, and when it is, it's derided as awful, but it can be pretty tasty.
I love krepalach.
You say it better than anyone too. And on that note, on thinking about krepalach and sabich and all the things that will electrocute us if we keep saying them into the microphones because of the moisture that's required to pronounce the words, I thank you for being here. Tell people how they can find out about the Kubeb project. Are there seats? Can anyone attend?
Walk-ins only. I mean, we have 3 special Shabbat dinners that are kind of sold out.
Okay.
But we'll serve similar foods throughout these 3 weeks, starting March 3rd at Zucker Bakery at East Village on 9th Street.
And is there an online place people can read about it or know about it?
I mean, we have a Facebook page, but if you just, you know,
just pop
Google,
in.
Just pop into the pop-up, yes.
Pop into the pop-up. Great. Well, thank you for being here. We'll look forward to 3 kinds of kubeh and preserving
thank
the traditions.
Thank you, Mitchell.
Next week, we are going to continue this conversation about Jewish food by talking to Noah Bermanoff from Mile End.
Nice.
Bermanoff. I always get that mixed up. And we'll talk about his table and forcing people to chat with each other at the sandwich shop and all sorts of other things about modern deli food. You're listening to Taste Matters. Eat some kreplach and sabich and all sorts of things. Hamantaschen. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.